Hi everyone, it's Ryan Hoover, your host of Product Hunt Radio, where I'm joined by the founders, investors, and makers that are shaping the future of tech. Today, Eric, one of the GPs at a relatively new firm called Hustle Fund, is joining me to chat about VC 101. Hustle Fund is a different type of VC firm. As you'll see on their website, they invest in hilariously early hustlers, as they describe it, and are often the first check in a new company. Prior to co-founding the fund, Eric served in a variety of operating roles as a product manager at Intuit, co-founder of a gaming company, started the startup to serve MBA students, and later was acquired, worked at Facebook, co-founded a media company called The Hustle, and served as an EIR at 500 Startups. I know that's a lot. On the podcast, we chat about the mechanics and misconceptions of VC, Eric's advice for those that want to break into venture, and Hustle Fund's unique data-driven approach to investing in early stage companies. But before I jump in, I want to give a shout out to our sponsors. Do you remember a time when you started working for yourself? It was certainly no small feat, and you've been insanely busy ever since. Our friends at FreshBooks are here to make things easier for freelancers like you. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed to save you time and all those terrible administrative tasks. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and get paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. Also, file expenses with ease to keep them perfectly organized for that lovely tax time. Go to freshbooks.com/producthunt and enter Product Hunt Radio in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. In addition to my day job at Product Hunt, I also invest in early stage startups through a fund I started. I called it Weekend Fund. At first, I was hesitant to invest in startups, worried that my time would get sucked away into back office management, LP tax reporting, and all the overhead that goes into managing a fund. Fortunately, AngelList Venture Services handle all that for me, so I can focus on finding and backing great entrepreneurs. So far, AngelList has hosted over 130 venture funds, ranging from $500,000 to several millions of dollars under management. The team is super knowledgeable, having supported hundreds of investors over the years, and eager to help fund managers plan a fundraising strategy. Once you've raised capital from LPs, you choose what startups to back, and AngelList handles the rest. If you're interested in investing in startups, take a look at angel.co/venturefunds, or email me at ryan@producthunt.com, and I'd be happy to help. Hey, how's it going, Eric?
Doing really well. Thanks so much, Ryan, for the opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah, we're chatting on President's Day. It's quiet in the office.
I know. I think we should be actually at home with our families, but still hustling hard, right?
I know. Yeah, we're podcasting instead. So speaking of hustling, you started a fund with Elizabeth, someone I've known actually before she was in venture, a fund called Hustle Fund. Can you talk more about maybe how that started and maybe some of your background?
Certainly. So Hustle Fund is an investment firm or venture capital firm focused on pre-seed investments. So generally, we try to be the institution that is alongside your Uncle Bob, your mom and dad, and some angels in your first tranche of capital that you're raising. So we focus on the software-enabled businesses space, which basically makes us a generalist fund because almost every company is software-enabled at this point. But I say that we index a little bit more heavily towards B2B with a long tail of consumer, a little bit of blockchain, fintech, digital health, etc. And we launched the fund in September 2017. $11.5 million when we closed last year. So we are firmly in what's called a micro fund class, maybe even a nano fund class of a early fund one.
Yeah, I've spoken to some people, and when I say micro fund, I think something that's around like sub $15 million, $10 million maybe. Some other people see it as $50 or $100 million funds, which seem pretty large to me. There's a lot of open definition there on kind of how to describe these different funds that are kind of emerging.
I think the answer is no one really knows how to describe it. Sub 100 million is, I think, the broadest definition I've seen. Although when you look at the class of new emerging managers coming out with their seed funds, and there's hundreds of them now, I'd say typically under 25 million is what I'm sort of seeing as the perhaps average.
Yeah. Mine is, I don't even know if nano is the right term, but $3 million fund is tiny compared to what you're doing and what others are doing. But how did you get into venture first? Like before this, you were an operator, you worked in a number of different companies.
Yeah.
Like what's your kind of give a quick background for you,
certainly,
for the audience?
So I'll start by saying that I never thought I'd ever want to be a venture capitalist. And the reason why was I always thought that I hated VCs. So my
those evil VCs out there. Yeah. I don't want to be one.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, some of them are jerks, but a lot of them actually turn out to be wonderful. I'm talking to one that's pretty cool. That's Ryan.
Oh.
So, Yeah, I mean, I spent my career as an operator, mainly in bootstrap businesses. So out of college, I was a sociology major, thought that I was going to be a lawyer. And then I realized after speaking to 12 attorneys in 12 different sectors of law that I absolutely was falling asleep every conversation, that I just had to reset my life. So this is after I got into law school and everything. So what happened was I was able to get a product management job at a great tech company called Intuit. They make TurboTax, Quicken, and QuickBooks.
I've used TurboTax many times. Right. It's a great product.
You might use QuickBooks too for past product hunt stuff, or at least your accountant did. And it was a great experience. But from that, was able to actually go full time on a company that I was sort of incubating on the side. This is really weird niche social network called Beat the GMAT, actually. And Beat the GMAT was just for people applying to business schools as a way for sharing data and helping each other out in that process. But that ended up becoming a 9-year project. We slowly bootstrapped that, turned that into a pretty scaled business, actually, on the data analytics side. And then I sold that to a media business in London called the Daily Mail Group. And then after that, I was at Facebook for a little bit. And then after that, wanted to go back and start my own company. And this is where I reunited with Elizabeth. She and I had been doing a bunch of side projects, one of which was called HustleCon earlier in our careers. And then she was leading the 500 Startups Accelerator. I was an EIR in her program. And fell in love with VC. And the reason why I fell in love was fundamentally our jobs are like the most blessed in the world because we just surround ourselves with people who have a worldview, have a product, have an idea that they wholeheartedly believe in. They're taking all the sacrifices to make that happen. And, you know, you and I may not agree all the time with whether their vision is the correct one to be successful, but it only leaves you with optimism. Like at the end of the day, just surrounding yourselves with these people and having an opportunity to just like learn a bunch of different industries, surround myself with these hyper optimistic people at the early stages. It just felt so gratifying. Right. And then I just got immediately hooked. And then from 500, we, you know, developed our own thesis for Hustle Fund, which we're employing today. And that's how we got started as GPs.
Yeah. What I love about talking to founders, especially ones early in the earliest stages, is that they have, in some ways, naive optimism. I certainly had some of that.
Totally.
But they have this strong perspective of the future and where it's going, and they are going to be the ones that build it. Like some of those people that you speak with are going to, not to be so cheesy, but like change the world in different aspects in certain ways. And that's what I also really enjoy talking with different founders, especially when they're building on nascent spaces. You and I are invested in a company called Voiceflow, which is building like tools for the future of voice apps. And that's such a cool area. I think the latest number is 61 million US homes have a smart speaker of some sort.
Wow.
That's up from 41, I think, before the holidays last year. So anyway, we're seeing a lot of adoption in the hardware side, yet it's still super early on the software side. Like, what can you build on this new platform? It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, on the note, the Voiceflow thing too, you know, I recently reshared one of your articles on the no code revolution that's happening right now. And this is actually one of the other kind of aspects that I really enjoy about VC is if you have a thesis about something that you'd like to see in the world, right, you can actually put your money behind where your mouth is. And for me, this one in particular, Voiceflow, but also this class of tools like Webflow, Retool, we were talking about before this conversation, is so exciting to me because that to me represents enfranchisement of builders who don't necessarily have to have coding backgrounds, but can still build amazing businesses. And suddenly 99% of people who fit that profile of no coders are able to build something and we can back them, right? So it's a really exciting time to see, you know, what secondary effects of innovation are going to happen as a result of this movement being successful.
Yeah. Yeah. Historically, it's been that, you know, to build something, if you were a designer or a marketer or whoever, product manager, you ultimately had to figure out, okay, how am I going to get this coded? How am I going to find someone to build this? And I faced that same challenge at Product Hunt in the early days. I initially started off as an email list because I, you know, didn't want to build or learn to code, you know, over several months just to see if people wanted this thing.
Yeah.
So the email is sort of the entry point, but then it was Nathan that kind of came along and we worked on it on the side for a while and he built the first version. In today, if Product Hunt was to start, I'd probably use something like Bubble to build it, you know? Bubble may not have all the features and everything that I need kind of long term for Product Hunt, but over a weekend I could probably replicate the majority of what Product Hunt's like core functionality is, which is like upvoting
at
comments,
like
etc.
Past that threshold of product market fit. That
yeah.
Probably would have been enough to get there. And then probably someone like a Nathan would be necessary to get that next stage. But just sometimes proof of product market fit is all you need, right? In order to get the rest of your team in together.
Yeah. So with Hustle Fund, there's like a million funds out there, including me in the early stages and others that are, they're investing and trying to find the next like big company. How do you approach it with Hustle Fund? And you and Elizabeth have a unique kind of approach to venture.
Yeah. So our thesis for our fund is driven around this notion that the single best leading indicator of success for a team that's discernible at the pre-seed stage is this characteristic called hustle, right? And for us, hustle is defined as great execution and high velocity. We think that teams that focus on a lot of code commits, a lot of experimentation, lots of aggressive movement on their sales pipelines, whatever those core metrics are that are relevant for your business at that stage, the teams that are just really growing aggressively against those metrics tend to just grind out the best results over time, right? The challenge for Hustle Fund, though, is that I can't listen to a pitch or look at a founder and say, Ryan is definitely a hustler, just after a few meetings. We actually need to observe their work. So what we do at Hustle Fund is a little bit weird. We're writing 100 checks into 100 teams at $25,000 a piece over 3 years. So 33 per year. We've done 61 checks so far. And we'll work with these teams on a growth project for 4 to 6 weeks, usually related to sales or user acquisition. And it's during that time, we can build some dashboards and take a look at their hustle metrics, work with these teams meaningfully on areas of growth that we have some expertise. And we can assess them better by watching them work. But reciprocally as well, and as critically, those teams are judging us to see whether as VCs, we actually can add value or whether we're just a dumb check that goes away, right? Like so many of our previous colleagues. So, you know, what we find is that if there's a really strong fit across the teams, the growth projects goes well, we're really impressed by the execution, the teams are impressed by our hustle too, and they're growing into a large market, we'll then ask to participate in a larger check of $250,000. And this happens about 20% of the cases, actually. So it's a pretty rigorous process, but we think that for all the teams that we work with, we can add a lot of value on the growth. And we're also a really fast decision because we're trying to just start working with as many teams as possible that seem to have potential. Yeah, so that's how our fund operates. It's a little bit unusual.
There's like a little bit of maybe you and Elizabeth's experience at 500 kind of mixed in there in the sense that it's not an accelerator, but you're doing something similar to what an accelerator would do, which is kind of work alongside the company in the earliest stages.
Oh, yeah, totally. And so much of our experiences running the previous accelerator has shaped this. So there'd be occasions where, just saying some context, between like 2,000 and 3,000 companies would apply for 50 spots every quarter at the 500 Startups Accelerator, running 4 times per year, once a quarter. And we would try to get these 50 companies in. There'd be an assessment. We'd interview them. They'd come in. These folks would look sometimes amazing on paper, just like Ryan Hoover, right? Just like, all handsome dude, like maybe you worked at like a Google or Facebook or something previously, you know, went to Stanford or MIT, checks all the boxes. And then you watch them work for the first week and you realize, wow, that person who was successful in the context of a different, larger company with more resources don't necessarily have the skills that translate to cold starting a business from scratch in a world of entropy where like there's no rules and no structure. So that person would sometimes just really flounder or fail and just couldn't execute. And then there'd be other people who fit unusual profiles who are just so tuned towards execution, learning and growth, and just had what it takes to build great businesses. So there are too many times that we're fooled, I think, at that accelerator, which allowed us to shape this thesis that we have that we're trying to operationalize with Hustle Fund.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really hard to evaluate. I mean, early stage when you don't have traction data, they haven't even launched in many cases.
Yeah, totally. Like,
how else do you evaluate them? It's based on, you know, you can evaluate the market. You can try to evaluate the person as much as you can. But, you know, when you have multiple data points, Mark Suster has a really good blog post that really burned into my brain a long time ago around like lines, not dots. And ultimately his position in that blog post is just he and many other investors tend to prefer to invest in people that they've been following and tracking for a while because they can see where they've been and where they're going. And in lieu of knowing someone up front, I think one strategy too, I think, and I don't know if you employ this strategy, but is trying to better understand what have been in the past month, the past 60 days, past 90 days, and trying to like replicate or understand those dots, I think in the past, like recent history can be really insightful too.
We try to build a lot of institutional knowledge by documenting. So every single deal that we write, even the small check deals, we'll do a deal memo, and then we'll rate the team actually on a number of criteria before, right as we write the check, and then about 6 weeks later after we worked with the teams on a growth project. And some of the things that we're trying to assess is just like, were there certain things like implicit bias that was affecting our judgments when we made this deal. Do we have like sort of dimensions of our own assessment as GPs that allow us to be really consistent? Like, I'm really good at figuring out people with product sense, but are just consistently weak on like market or something like that. This was actually really inspired by a learning that Elizabeth had from Gus Tai at Trinity Ventures. Apparently, he's really, really good at this kind of postmortem documentation. And that allows him to have like his own kind of institutional check on his own decision making, because he knows he's really weak on some areas, but just consistently nails it in others.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the feedback loops are so long too, and it's hard to remember what did I think of at that time, and what was I actually using to, you know, as inputs to make that decision and that check.
Yeah.
When the outcome, the liquidity event might be 5-8 years later.
Exactly.
It's really hard.
Yeah, so we'll find out really in 10 years how well we're doing, but you got to find something to hold on to, I guess, as a feedback loop. And we have our own mechanisms. We'll see if they're actually working over time.
Yeah. So one thing that I think a lot of people just don't really understand is how VC works, and, you know, what is the difference between a micro VC and, you know, a bigger firm like Andreessen Horowitz, and how they operate. Like, very, very different type of organizations. I don't know. Do you want to do like maybe like a one-on-one on VC, and maybe, I don't know, even know how the economics work, and how do you make money? Like, let's break it down.
Let's do it. So I think that there is a pretty stark difference between emerging managers who are in this microfund class versus those that maybe are the traditional stereotype of venture capitalists. Those that are sitting in Sand Hill Row with hundreds of millions, billions of dollars under management. When you're operating a microfund, particularly in the early days, it feels much more similar to the experience that the founders are having, right? It's a lot of hustle to get those first few checks. Oftentimes, a fund size is relatively small given the peer group. $10 million, let's say. Our fund is 11.5. So one stereotype on my break is, and this was actually triggered by an article that a friend of ours, Kate Clark at TechCrunch, a lot of love for Kate, but she wrote this article about like the average salary of VCs is like $354,000 or something like that. And then my response when I tweeted back to her was like, I make $54,000 a year, and that's going to be my salary for fund one. So, you know, we're living pretty lean as well. Our founders are trying to build our brands, you know, try to cold start deal flow, all the things that maybe some of the larger VC funds that have like the brand kind of pull can sort of take as just like a natural position in their world order. So, for example, a Sequoia, which has an exceptional brand, they get to see the very best deals. They have the best founders that are trying to constantly pitch them. So while they're not, I'd say, lazy or complacent, I wouldn't call any of those partners in those terms, they actually do have the benefit of enjoying the farming aspects. Like, the brand of Sequoia is already there, so they can be farmers and filtering the very best deal flow in the world, right? So deal flow, brand is there. And of course, if Sequoia is in your round, they can dictate terms. When you're a new fund, starting like Eric and Ryan Fund or something, or Weekend Fund or an Hustle Fund, more accurately, you know, people often haven't heard of you before. So you have to go in there with some sort of edge, a real story of like, this is how I can actually help you beyond this small check. And then you're also fighting other things too, like, you know, well, we have a big fund as a lead. They want to squeeze out everyone, making the case to the founders like, no, like, you know, please let us in. Here are the reasons why this could be really great to fight for allocation and so forth. So I say there's like a brand difference. The other part too is just there's a different kind of mindset also in terms of what the GP is thinking at any given time. So I'd say that I'm thinking of three things as an emerging manager. A third of my time is spent with deal sourcing and working with my portfolio. So I'm trying to find new great deals of people to fund and trying to work with my existing portfolio to help them to get better, right? That's a really enjoyable part of my time. The other third is actually fundraising. And you're constantly fundraising. So even if you've closed your fund, you always have to be on the lookout for your next LPs. Most funds usually get larger. So it takes larger checks and bigger, and I guess a larger, I guess, network to get there. So fundraising, meeting prospective LPs, telling them about the story of your fund is a huge part of your time. That's also really enjoyable as well, especially if you find the right fit. And then the last part, fund administration. So, you know, those small things that it takes to run a business, like the legal, making sure that you have good communication with your LPs through LP communication, taxes and audit. These are small things that add up to be quite a bit of your time. So when you think about it, when you're an emerging manager cold starting everything, 2/3 of your time is already removed from actually working directly with your portfolio and sourcing deals. And it's a really difficult and surprising thing for most new managers to understand.
Yeah, I think a lot of people underestimate the LP fundraising aspect. So those that have founded a company, the fundraising process, there's some similarities to raising for a fund, but it's also wildly different. And when you're fundraising as a founder for a company, usually you have some sense of, there's an element of urgency and timeliness in many cases where you can manufacture a close and a decision. Whereas when you're raising for a fund, a lot of LPs, they don't really need to deploy capital today or next month. Right. And so to your point, that's why it requires this ongoing fundraising and relationship building kind of process.
Yeah.
You know, for several years. And so depending on your fund deployment window, you know, every 2 to 4 years, you're raising another fund.
That's right. I've been told that if you can stay in the game long enough and do good work by fund 6, it's a lot easier to do that fundraising, but that's now 18 years because typically you're raising every maybe 3 years for the next fund. So that's a pretty long feedback loop in the theme of feedback loops. So, you know, less money than you think in being a microfund manager. A lot of time spent on actually not even portfolio work or deal sourcing as a microfund manager. I'll say this though, it's the greatest job in the world. I mean, like, again, just being able to get out there, especially when you're doing seed, and be first believer, because oftentimes those are the deals that are the least competitive, where you have real disproportionate influence in finding those companies that feature founders who are just getting going, that have huge potential. And you can see it even before they do sometimes. That's what makes this job so special.
So how do you make money? Can you break down some of the, like, what is carry and management fees and all of that? Because I know a lot of people just don't, I think, understand or even have visibility into, like, the economics of a VC.
Yeah, and this is actually a really important one to understand. So I have actually a really cynical view, and this is actually where I feel like a lot of people develop poor views of venture capital, is around this notion of management fee and carry. So quite simply, so management fee is a percentage, typically, of the total assets under management that can be carved out each year to pay yourself. So let's go with a very simple example. Let's say that you have a $10 million fund. You've raised $10 million of LP money. A typical fund life is about 10 years. So over the course, 10 years, each year you can pull off, let's say, 2%, which is a very typical management fee target. 2% of total assets under management, $200,000 a year for the next 10 years. And that is going to help fund your salary, your healthcare, branding of events, things like that. If you have multiple people like I do in my team, that could be really small salaries for everyone. So that's the management fee part of it. It's a function of the total assets that you have under management, and it's typically percentage. Carry, let's call it, I think the very easiest way to think of it is the profit, like share of profit that you can earn for your LPs. So if I have a $10 million fund, I've raised $10 million. What happens is if I invest well, the first $10 million goes immediately back to my investors. So they get their money returned to them. That's called returning the fund. And anything else that's above that, I get 20% of. That's a 20% carry, which is very
typical. Yeah, typical 80-20 split is exactly. Pretty standard. Yeah.
Let's say I make $20 million in the fund, first $10 million back to LPs. The next $10 million, I get 20% of that. That's $2 million. And then the $8 million goes back to the LPs. So 2 and 20. Now, I'd say that in the purest sense, venture capital works best when the activities are indexed towards carry, meaning like I should get compensated when I find great companies to invest in. The founders get rich, my investors get rich, and then I get rich at the end of this journey. And that typically happens, you know, in the later years of a fund, maybe years 7 to 10, when the companies have matured and have a chance to actually produce some liquidity in the form of an exit or an IPO. The other sort of way that I can get rich, though, is through management fee. So let's say that I'm a shitty investor, but I'm insanely good at fundraising. So I start with a $10 million fund, and then I raise a $100 million fund, and then I raise a $500 million fund. I can do this really well because I'm great at storytelling to LPs, and I maybe have the right connections. Well, let's take a simple example, $100 million under management. I can carve off $2 million a year sitting on my ass making crappy investments for 10 years, and I will be rich.
You know, like guaranteed.
Guaranteed, right? Yeah. The investors aren't necessarily guaranteed to be rich. The founders are not necessarily to get like great support from me either, if I only want to play the assets under management game. And this is something that I really enjoy talking about, because you will know sometimes when you're talking to a venture capitalist who's playing the assets under management game, they seem too complacent, they're in no rush, they seem to play a little bit too much golf, they seem to be too ready to show them their collection of Ferraris. And like, maybe I'm being a little bit too negative. There may be VCs who fit that profile, but are still hustling hard. But there are definitely some who are just sitting pretty, you know, just enjoying the fruits of management fee. And here's a pitch, I think, for why working with a microfund early is great for the founders is like, we can't necessarily afford to do that at all, right? Like, our incentives are actually proving that that chip on our shoulder is not like, you know, like, we have that chip on our shoulder to just like go out and invest well, because it's really by like showing some early traction and making some good bets early is how we're going to be able to survive and get to that next stage.
I've noticed some first fund managers seem to be the hardest working sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
And again, to your point too, like, that's not to say like the seniors and the vets in the game aren't, you know, hustling and working their ass off. And there's certainly a lot of people who are way better than me, but I as a first time fund manager, I have a lot to prove and I need to prove that I'm good at this. And it will take a long time and there's long feedback loops, but I've noticed from some patterns of like, these people are really working really hard for their portfolio because they want to raise another fund in the future. they don't have it guaranteed.
So like, it's a little unfair because I don't want to necessarily ascribe that anyone working in a big fund is lazy, because you're right. Like, there's so many hardworking people in this network. But I also like maybe comparing this to music. This is like indie rock, right? We're not U2. Like, we haven't made it yet. Like, we're indie rock. We're playing those small shows, playing those small gigs, and it just makes you literally hungry, right? To be out there and like making the small checks for now, but hopefully living the big dream to just like build that next franchise fund that can support like the next generation of incredible like innovators, right? But this is it's important like to just at least have that sort of context in mind of just like, management fee and carry can produce very different kinds of like behavioral economics as you work with your VC, like, and you start to class this person as someone that's like, this is definitely a lazy person who is just, you know, enjoying life in the golf course, then you may have a very different experience working with that person.
Yeah. So for those that want to get into venture, I don't know, I'm sure people have asked you this before, but like, what's your advice? Is there a path or a way that you'd recommend people explore?
Yeah. So I have a very ugly answer and then I have a more tactical answer. The ugly answer is privilege. So what I mean by that is, I don't know how anyone can really do venture capital full time unless they're already rich, right? Like, the reality is, like, you know, my wife is also a founder and I'm a founder of a fund, and collectively we make about $80,000 a year. And we live in the San Francisco Bay Area, which we're lucky to do. It's lucky that we had an exit previously too. So we have some liquidity. We have childcare. We have a mortgage. We're probably net negative $100,000 a year. Right. So that actually means that at least for 3 years, I have $300,000 that I can draw down to at least to like make our lives sustainable as we're trying to prove our fund. And there are definitely exceptions of people who don't come from like some level of like net worth that's pretty comfortable, who have made it as fund managers. So I really admire folks like Arlen Hamilton at Backstage Capital. She was previously like homeless a few years ago, but was just like sleeping in the San Francisco airport lobby while she was raising her fund. And she found a way to grind out and do it. That's an outlier example. I mean, most people actually come from like pretty good careers, made pretty good money, saved up a pretty good amount.
One thing we didn't talk about too is GP commit. Like, typically you also commit a large portion of the funds to the fund itself.
Generally at least 1%.
Yeah. Right?
So like, you know, if I'm raising a $10 million fund, I'm putting in $100,000 as well. So like, all these things are real factors where just, and like, I think your listeners should really understand that these are institutional barriers that make it very, very hard to get immediately into raising your first fund unless you have some resources available against it. It can be overcome by great network, possibly, you know, your parents maybe, if you're lucky enough to chip in and give you a little bit of a loan, all that stuff. In my case too, like, we're comfortable, but I had to take a $150,000 loan out of my house in order to get started for fund one. Recently paid that back, which is good.
Great.
But like, you know, that's, it kind of drew down in other areas too. So I'd say like, just reality, dude, like, privilege is something that makes it far easier. Going to good schools, working at great places, and having money, right? Now, maybe the answer you're expecting is like, tactically, like, how do you get started? So again, kind of related, privilege. Like, I was an angel investor for 6 years prior to starting this fund. Elizabeth as well. And then she and our third GP in Singapore was also an active angel investor. So there's some semblance of a track record that we could point to show that like, we got into some good deals and like, this is something that can demonstrate some good judgment as investors, right? One thing I would recommend for any fund ones out there is, we also made the choice of warehousing all of our angel investments into fund one.
Oh, interesting.
So what that means, warehousing is, you sell the deal that you bought in at cost into the fund. So there's some insanely good investments that we've made. One of which I'm really proud of. My very first angel investment was Webflow on no code, and they're doing great. Vlad and team are crushing it. Was an angel investor for a tiny check, and then sold that at that exact same level 7 years later.
Wow.
Into the fund. The reason why you may want to do that, it's a good story to tell to your LPs of like, look, you'll have some guaranteed winners in the fund. And also it's a way of demonstrating I'm not going to have any conflicts of interest. Like anything that I did in the past as an angel investor, you are going to enjoy in the future and in the present.
That's a smart tactic because you're basically, you're also giving something for them to take a chance on you kind of as a first fund manager in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, it's like icing on the cake. Like most funds don't come in, you know, with investments with some prior markups and maybe some history like that.
Totally. And like the markups are fun because, so just a definition of markup, it's when you can see a paper valuation gain. So let's say I invest in Ryan's Product Hunt version 2 company for $1 million of valuation. And then he raises at a $10 million valuation later on. In this very, very simple world, like that would be a 10x markup, no dilution included in this scenario. And you can sort of point to that as a story saying like, look, I'm 10x on this one deal to an investor, and sometimes that can be helpful in putting them over the edge to invest in you.
Yeah, it's a fascinating world. I think I'm curious to see how it evolves. I think we're seeing more people in the earlier stages become equipped with capital to in some ways address some of the privilege issues. It's not certainly fixed by any means.
Yeah.
But programs like Spearhead are deploying capital into founders to deploy capital into startups. And these are people doing it on the side, not full time. So they don't have to pay a salary, but they earn economics, they earn carry.
So Scout funds, I think, have been pretty good in helping to bring up that next emerging manager class. There's ways to get other people's money, I guess, and showing that you can responsibly deploy it. I know that you work at AngelList. I'm going to sort of shill for you guys. I think
go for it.
Like spiritually, your team with like Tommy, Sunil, everyone, Mike, you really, really get this as well as like as an institutional problem. So like I've been pretty pleased by seeing some of the support systems around like SPVs, AngelList funds, some of the new programs you guys are thinking about designing as well to support early managers. And I really do hope that venture capital becomes accessible for more emerging managers, because if it doesn't, and the same kinds of profile of rich people are just becoming emerging managers, then that's not so good when it comes to diversity of ideas or innovation, right, in this market, right? We'll just be the same old dudes eventually playing golf, you know, at the end of our careers.
So. Nothing against golf. Golf's fine. Not my game.
Golf is cool, I guess. I've been playing it since I was 10 as well. But
yeah. Well, there's an interesting, going back to the no-code kind of theme and movement too, in the future, if more people can build things, at least in the beginning from the start, without having to either be an engineer or recruit an engineer, and two, we have more people from different backgrounds investing in these early ideas, those two things combined will actually open up so many more ideas and at least get things off the ground that maybe would have never gotten off the ground 5 or 10 years ago because they weren't an engineer and so they just weren't able to like see their idea to the market, or because they couldn't get funding because, you know, traditional VCs just didn't see the vision or the opportunity.
What's so exciting about the times that we live in, and there's a lot that can make it feel negative sometimes, but this actually really pulls me forward, is like I 100% believe in the no-code revolution that's about to happen. And I really think that 99% of people will now start to be able to build. So theoretically, we have a near 100x number of great companies that could form, right? And there's still, even today, with all the micro funds out there, all the venture capitals that are very well funded with storied funds, like there needs to be more investors out there to support them. Right. And if the mechanisms are right, some of the efforts behind like AngelList and so forth become right to draw in that pool of potentially great next generation investors to support this crazy amount of innovation is about to be unleashed, then we're all going to be better for it. Right. There's going to be more people who can have accessibility and can be introduced and have a path into venture capital. But also, more importantly, the founders will have more mechanisms to get the funding to unlock themselves.
Yeah. Brilliant. I'm optimistic. Future is going to be good. Where can they find you? If people want to reach out to you on Hustle Fund or follow you on Twitter, where do they find you?
Yeah. So our website's hustlefund.vc, Victor Charlie. We review every single deal that happens through that website form. In fact, we insist every founder to fill it out before we talk to them. So please check that out, hustlefund.vc. And then talk to me at on Twitter at Eric Bahn, E-R-I-C-B-A-H-N. I'm constantly just retweeting Ryan Hoover stuff. So it's just like, you know, a less good version of Ryan Hoover's tweets.
You're filtering out all my other junk.
Exactly. If you want to see only the important stuff,
only the Ryan good tweets, stuff from Ryan, follow Eric. That's how it works.
Just follow my curated feed. No, that's Twitter's I'm really active in, and I love engaging with folks there to talk about ideas.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks for coming on, Eric.
Thanks for the opportunity, man.
Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. But in the meantime, share the podcast with your friends on Twitter and tag a guest you'd like to hear in a future episode. See you soon.